Turn to 1 Samuel 17. Have you all ever met anybody in your life that was just gigantic? I mean a big person. Big stature, big body. They're just huge. Do you all remember Lorenzo Coleman that played basketball at Tech? I remember when I was a kid, I was maybe 6, 7, 8 years old or something. Lorenzo was playing at Tech. According to Wikipedia, unfortunately he passed away, had a heart condition, and I'm sure it's something that's fairly common with people his size. He was 7'1", 264 pounds. And I remember he shattered the backboard at Tech one time. And I thought it was the coolest thing because that broken backboard stayed laying down the tunnel for a little while and still had some glass around it before they get it cleaned up. And I crawled down underneath the tarp one time and got a piece of glass out and took home. Of course, cut my knees up and everything else. But I always thought it was so cool because I got my picture made with him once, and he was just this towering beast. I'm 7, 8 years old. I'm barely to his waist. He's the biggest guy I'd ever met in my life. I looked up online the tallest players to ever play in the NBA. They've got listed, there's 25 players that stood 7'3" or taller. Now the tallest one, there was two guys that were 7'7". Lorenzo Coleman was 7'1". Just for a little reference, Shaquille O'Neal is 7'1". So there's somebody that's a good 6 inches taller than Shaq. Two of them that have played in the NBA. We're big Yankees fans. And so I've been reading a book here lately about Aaron Judge that plays right field for the Yankees. And just his size in comparison, he's 6'8", weighs about 280, 285 pounds, somewhere around that. That's a big guy. I mean, that's 20 pounds heavier than Gronk that plays for the New England Patriots. He's a big guy. But yet he's still almost a foot smaller than the tallest people that have played in the NBA. So, I mean, there's huge people that have lived. Does anybody know who the biggest person on record is? Now, this is secular history, recorded Guinness Book of World Records when you had doctors that could check everything. So there may have been people taller back in history. Does anybody know who it is? If you've been to the Ripley Museum in Gatlinburg or somewhere else, you've probably stood next to a wax figure of him. His name is Robert Wadlow. Lived in February 1918 to July, well, this says 2940. That's not right. I would assume that's supposed to be 1940. And he had a lot of medical conditions because of his size, could hardly walk when he got older, but he stood at 8'11.1" tall. It was 9 foot tall. You can't walk in a normal house like that. I mean, your head is like dragging the ceiling when you still got your neck turned over to the side. So, when we think back to the Bible, though, who do we normally think of as the giant in the Bible? Goliath. There are several of you said it. Goliath is who we think of. And I had you turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 17. And I'd love to have some people read, but I also know it'd be hard to hear everyone if we did that. So I'm going to read some of the passages tonight. So Goliath, it says here, his height was 6 cubits in a span. Now, how big is a cubit? 18 inches. That's the fairly common measurement that we know it as, is 18 inches. It could go up to 21. I've got that written down here. Normally, we assume a foot and a half because that's good round numbers, and so you can estimate easily with that. So if we assume that it was 18 inches, that would have made Goliath 9'9" tall. The biggest person in recorded history was 8'11". So he would have been, 10 inches taller than that? But some historians believe that a cubit could have actually gone up to 21 inches. The measurement of the cubit, I believe, is at the length of the forearm to the little finger. So your elbow to your little finger. Well, if I put my arm up next to Reed's, I mean, they're probably not going to be exactly the same size. I mean, whose arm were they using to measure it off of? So it could have gone up to 21 inches. If we use the 21 inch, Goliath was 11 feet, 4.5 inches tall. That's a big guy. And you're not talking just this tall, lanky guy who's nothing but skin and bones, and you go over and blow on him and he's going to fall over. I mean, he had the meat to back this up. Look over in verse 5, 1 Samuel chapter 17. Said he had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed with scale armor. So basically he had chainmail. He had chainmail on. which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. Now, a shekel is approximately 11 grams. So he has this coat of mail on that weighs 5,000 shekels, so about 55,000 grams. You're talking a little over 121 pounds. Just the armor on his torso is 121 pounds that he's carrying with him. Verse 6, he also had bronze greaves on his legs and a bronze javelin slung between his shoulders. So that's not counting the weight of everything else that he had on him. Now remember, David, when they tried to put Saul's armor on David, what did he tell him to do? He said, get it off of him. Why? It's too heavy. He can't move, he can't walk, he can't do anything. I can't believe that Saul's armor was as big as what Goliath's armor is. Just because, I mean, I imagine Saul was not that big of a guy, as otherwise the Bible I would have thought would have mentioned somebody. It did say that he was a head taller than everybody else and was very handsome and all that when he was anointed. But I got to imagine that Saul's armor was probably a little bit smaller than Goliath's. So it probably didn't weigh as much. So Goliath's a big guy. Look at his spear in verse 7. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and the head of his spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. So again, if we go off that same analogy, the head of the spear weighed 14 and a half pounds. I mean, have you ever tried to take a 10-pound weight and throw it? You know, throw it. How heavy is a shot put? You might know. 8 pounds? So you take a shot. So he's almost throwing two shot put balls. And that's what the head of his spear weighed. This is a big, big guy. I mean, I'm imagining somebody that's got the stature of Shaquille O'Neal. Not just as tall, I mean, taller than him, but he's built. He's got a big body to go with it. So, I'm saying all that for a reason, and I want to get to a couple things. There's a couple other giants that the Bible talks about. Turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 3. Deuteronomy chapter 3 and verse 11. There's two I want us to look at in Deuteronomy. So Deuteronomy 3 verse 11, it says, "For only Og, king of Bashan, was left of the remnant of the Rephaim." And I don't know if I'm saying those right. It says, "Behold, his bedstead was an iron bedstead. It is in Rabbah of the sons of Ammon. Its length was 9 cubits and its width 4 cubits by ordinary cubit." So again, if we go off the assumption that a cubit is a foot and a half, his bed is 13 and a half feet long. I mean, we have a king-size bed. When I lay down in it, my feet come close to the end of it. I mean, you're talking, what, 6.5-foot bed or something. It's like two king-size beds laid end to end. His bed was bigger than that. Again, this is a big guy. Jump over to chapter 9. Deuteronomy chapter 9. Verses 1 and 2. It says, "Hear, O Israel, you are crossing over the Jordan today to go in to dispossess nations greater and mightier than you, great cities fortified to heaven, a people great and tall, the sons of the Anakim, whom you know and of whom you have heard it said, who can stand before the sons of Anak?" So again, you have an entire race of people who are big, big people, the sons of Anakim. Okay, so be turning over to Numbers chapter 13. And it may seem like we're jumping around a little bit, but I promise you this is all going to come back into something. Well, I hope it does. It will in my mind. I hope you all get it too. Numbers chapter 13. So we all know the story of the children of Israel. They're brought out of Egypt. Moses goes and gets them. 10 plagues. They're out in the wilderness. They're traveling through the wilderness, and they're heading to the promised land. They're headed to Canaan. Okay, and so they get to the edge of Canaan. They're getting ready to go in, and what is it that they do in Numbers 13? What is the leaders of the tribes and Moses and Aaron, what do they decide to do? They sent the spies in. Why in the world would they send spies into Canaan? That's a big one right there. Put yourself in their shoes from a military standpoint. There would be a lot of military advantage to knowing what in the world you're getting yourself into, right? Where are the strongholds at? What is the topography of the land like? What areas do we need to avoid? Are there certain valleys? Are there forests or something that we can use to our advantage? Are there mountain ranges that we can we can use to sneak around? What is the topography like? Would they have needed all that had they trusted God? No. But they send the spies in. Listen to Numbers 13. Start reading verse 17. It says, when Moses sent them out to spy up the land, well, I'll tell you what, for time's sake, ask the unprofessionals class. I may come in with like two chapters of stuff I want to go over and we get through like three verses. So I'm not going to read all that. It's the information about Moses sending them into the land. So they go in. It's 40 days later before the spies come back. Now, I try to put myself in the people's shoes when I read passages like this. What would Moses have been thinking? What would have the leaders of the different tribes have been thinking when they're waiting on these guys to come back? It's been over a month now. Did they get killed? Are they lost? Who knows? Are they traitors? Did they go and try to get to the other side? Verse 26. Numbers 13, verse 26. So 40 days later, they come back. It says, they proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. So I can imagine at this point, Moses, everybody else, they're sitting on the edge of their seats to hear what in the world these guys found out. So they start telling them the things they found. And they're carrying with them fruit that they found. It says, and they brought back word to them and all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Thus they told him and said, we went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Oh boy. I mean, these guys have been waiting for over a month to hear this back, and they get the best news they could have possibly got. This place is golden. This is what we've been promised. This is the promised land we're supposed to inherit. It's not just a barren wasteland. We're finally going to get this great and mighty reward we've always wanted. But then they get the bad news, the yeah, but, in verse 28. It says, nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large, and moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Now, just imagine the wind just falling out of you. Like, do you think they knew who the descendants of Anak were? We just read in Deuteronomy that the family of Anak, the Anakim, the descendants of them, oh no. Yeah, you got all this stuff. Yeah, it's a great land, but what are we going to do? Caleb now steps in at this point, and he basically says, he sees what's happening. They're going to want to try to back out, and he's like, nope, let's go. Let's go. Everybody come on. Caleb's trying to lead them on. They don't follow him. Look at verse 31. It says, but the men who had gone up with him said, we're not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us. So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land, which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, are part of that, and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. When I stood next to Lorenzo Coleman that time, I felt like a grasshopper. If you've ever been next to somebody who is just big, I mean a gigantic person, you feel tiny, especially as a little kid. I was just dwarfed, and I remember it like it was yesterday. That's how the spies said they felt. As grown men going out there, they felt like grasshoppers compared to these people. They found giants in this land. All right, so that now is the reason why they didn't get to go into the promised land. They're now out wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. That's their punishment because they didn't trust God enough to go into Canaan and be able to overthrow everything. God sends them to the wilderness to basically roam around lost until that entire generation died off and a new generation came in. All except two people. Who were the two people that got to go? Joshua and Caleb. They were the two that came back and said, no, we can do this. We have God on our side. So they were allowed to go into it. So, they go in, and they start to try to overthrow. Now, who exactly is this race of Anak, the Anakim? So we hear now that the Israelites, when they come out from spying the land in Canaan, they come back and talk about them. We read over in Deuteronomy about this race. So who exactly are these people? I'm glad you asked. Deuteronomy chapter 2. Deuteronomy chapter 2, look at verse 10 and 11. It says, the Amim, again, I don't know if I'm saying that right, they lived there formerly, a people as great, numerous, and tall as the Anakim. Like the Anakim, they are also regarded as Rephaim, but the Moabites call them the Emim. These are big people of great size. So imagine not only where David went out to fight Goliath, who was a big, big guy. Imagine an entire race of Goliaths, possibly some bigger than he was. So not only do you have Goliath there, and some people believe Goliath himself may have been a descendant from this group. I mean, there's no evidence or proof to back that up. It's just assumptions. Imagine you have Goliath and his brothers and his parents and maybe his kids and his first cousins and his fifth cousins and their dogs who were probably big. And you had an entire village of people who were just beasts. Now imagine those 12 spies going in and looking and they see them. And I was like, wait, we've got to go fight those guys? How in the world are we going to fight those guys? We're grasshoppers compared to them. There's no possible way we can take on a challenge that big. Now, let me ask you this. If you think of, in the Bible, the giant slayer, the giant killer in the Bible, who would you normally think of? David. David's the giant killer. He's the one who slew Goliath. Would you be surprised if I told you there's another one who was maybe a better giant slayer than David? Turn over to Joshua 14. The reason we don't normally think of this man as a giant slayer is because you don't normally hear the story about him very much. Because there's not really a lot said about it. David, there's this great big long story. It's a fascinating tale that you can tell to children in Bible classes that they can relate to easily. There's a lot of details. Look at Joshua 14. Let's start reading verse 6. It says, "Then the sons of Judah drew near to Joshua in Gilgal, and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, 'You know the word which the Lord spoke to Moses, the man of God, concerning you and me in Kadesh Barnea.'" So now Caleb's coming up to Joshua and he's saying, "Look, you remember this, me and you are the only two left from the group that was wandering in the wilderness." Imagine the stories that they told everybody, because they're the only ones remembered what it was like in Egypt. Everybody else at that point had died off, except maybe the little young kids. Everybody down to a certain age had died out. So he says, "I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land." So Caleb was 40 years old when they went in as spies. "And I brought back word to him as it was in my heart. Nevertheless, my brethren who went up with me made the heart of the people melt with fear, but I followed the Lord my God fully. So Moses swore on that day, saying, 'Surely the land on which your foot has trodden will be an inheritance to you and your children forever, because you have followed the Lord my God. Now behold, the Lord has let me live, just as he spoke these 45 years. So 45 years later, Caleb's 85. "From the time that the Lord spoke this word to Moses, when Israel walked in the wilderness, and now behold, I'm 85 years old today. I am still as strong today as I was in the day of Moses, the day Moses sent me, and my strength was then, so my strength is now, for war and for going out and coming in." But listen to this right here. Verse 12. It says, "Now then, give me this hill country about which the Lord spoke on that day, for you heard on that day that Anakim were there, with great fortified cities. Perhaps the Lord will be with me, and I will drive them out as the Lord has spoken." So Joshua blessed him and gave Hebron to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, for an inheritance. So when Joshua led the children of Israel into Canaan, and they started pushing people back, and they started winning all these wars, one of the things they had to do was to wipe out or push out this race of the Anakim, the children of Anak. They didn't completely kill them all, but they pushed them out of the area and they settled in a certain region. And so now they're all confined to this certain region. So when Caleb comes to Joshua and says, "Look, you remember when we came back and we had spied out the land and we gave a good report, Moses told us that we could have what we wanted in there because me and you did what we were supposed to have done. We followed God fully. So that's 45 years ago. I'm 85 years old now. I want you to go ahead and give me mine. Now put yourself in Caleb's shoes. You're 85 years old. What land would you have picked? Would it have been a situation where you go in and say, look, I'm ready to retire. Okay? I don't have the energy anymore to go over and do this. I've done my dues. It's time for a younger generation to come in and do something. So I want to go see this area over here where it's kind of nice and calm. I can raise my family there. We can kind of spread our cattle out. We can do whatever. But that's not what he did. He took a problem that, remember, Goliath was one man that by himself was holding back the entire army of Israel. Caleb said, I want to take over the land that has an entire race of Goliaths. You give me that. That's the area that I want to inherit that Moses said I could have. So he took a problem that we would see is one of the biggest problems in our mind, something that is so monstrous that there's no way possible we could accomplish it. And Caleb said, give it to me. I'm ready to take it on head on. So where all this is coming to now, hopefully back full circle, is what problems do we see in our life today? Think about in the church. Problems that you would describe that are just so monstrosities of issues that there's no way possible that me as one person could have any impact on it. Name some. What are some issues in the church that go on? And I'm not meaning necessarily here at Willow. The church globally. Yeah, respect for God's Word. Respect for God's Word is huge. What about the push of homosexuality throughout our country? And that, in and of itself, is infiltrating itself into the Lord's church. You've got issues of liberalism, where you now are seeing women up in the pulpits and working as elders and stuff. There's all these things that are going on in the world today that are affecting the church. And we look at those things, and it may just take the wind out of your sails. Look, the church is big, but it's nothing compared to the size of people who aren't in the church. How in the world could me as one person, or even us as a congregation, possibly go out and attack this problem? You're hitting the point perfectly right there. Why was it that Caleb wasn't scared to go in and tackle a problem that basically scared an entire army? He trusted God. He was one man by himself. Now, granted, he probably had a huge family with him. So when he went in there, it probably wasn't just him in a tent. There was probably an entourage of people that went with him, that he was the leader of that group. But he was willing to step up and say, my group, we can take this. We can do this. Let us do it. Because he trusted God, and he knew he was going to succeed because of that. What issues do we face in the church today that we kind of cower back from because we're too scared to take it on? That we think, well, there's nothing really that I can do. I mean, how in the world am I going to go out and preach the gospel to an entire world of people when they don't even seem to want to hear it? I'm supposed to love the soul of the terrorist who is out beheading people right now, and instead of me trying to kill that person, maybe I could save their soul. How am I supposed to have that kind of an attitude of not seeing people that are beneath me out there because they're not Christians, that they're not in a right relationship with God? How is it that I'm supposed to see them as a soul that needs saving when I think in my mind there's no chance of saving them anyways? They don't want to listen to me. So why even try? Yeah. Some people, you can't. Exactly. But does that mean we shouldn't even attempt it? Now, and there comes a point where he says, look, if they don't want it, they don't want it. Here's easier, lower-hanging fruit over here. Don't waste all your time with somebody who's not going to listen to you. But does that mean that we can't see that person as a soul that needs saving? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep. That everything that Christ went through, look at the one problem he tackled by himself. Now you may say, yeah, he was the Son of God. Yes, he was the Son of God. but he was still in human form. He still felt the same pain. He still felt the same emotions we would have felt in his position. And he went through every bit of that persecution knowing that there was a greater good on the other end. And it's this whole mindset of getting yourself past this worldly concept that we have. That all we want to do is focus on what's right here in front of us, and we don't see this end picture. We see this life beyond earth, and we know there's a greater good coming. It's almost like this whole mindset of mind over body, mind over matter. That can I put pain aside? Can I put difficulty aside? Because I know that what I'm working towards is something that's so much bigger. That the reward is going to be so much greater than whatever persecution I might go through here. Do you think that was maybe the mindset that Caleb had when he was willing to go into this land full of people that were possibly 3 and 4 feet taller than Shaq? That are several feet taller than the biggest NBA players that have ever played. And not just taller, that are big, big guys. That are wearing chainmail that weighs 150 pounds. And a lot of us can't even pick up 150 pounds. They're just walking around like a shirt. I mean, what are other issues that we deal with? That it seems today that Christians, and I'm just as guilty of this, so I'm talking to myself, it's not just everybody else. Evolution taught in schools. Have we got to a point to where we just look at it and it's like, look, it just is what it is. It's life now. We've just got to figure out a way to deal with it. Yeah. Exactly. But there's so many of us that we're not even willing to get into the discussion. Because like, look, I'm not even going to mess with it. Fine, you all teach evolution. I'll make sure I teach my kids what they need to know. Why are we not willing to take on these battles? There was a big push a couple years ago. It was the Yes on One campaign. Y'all remember that? Where they had the amendment to vote yes on one dealing with abortion. That was something that I could actually look at and it's like, wow. It seems like whether it's people actually in the Lord's church or just the quote-unquote Christian world in general, use that term very loosely, stood up and pushed on something and pushed back against what people normally would say, there's nothing we can do about it. It's, the ball's already rolling down the hill. There's nothing we can do to stop it. What I want us to get at is, do we have this mindset that Caleb had, that he sees this problem in front of him that is just a monstrosity that so many people would cower back from? And just like, look, I don't even want to take it on. I can't mess with that. I don't have time for that. I've got so many other things going on in my life right now that I've got responsibilities over here. I've got my kids to deal with. I've got grandkids to deal with. I've got to do this. I've got to do that. And the whole time, we're ignoring the elephant sitting in the corner. And it may just be this problem that needs to be addressed. And maybe God is waiting for someone to finally step up and take the bull by the horns and try to do something. Are we willing to do that as Christians? Because that's exactly what Caleb did. Because had Caleb not gone in there and pushed this whole race of people back out of this area that they had kind of settled into, what would have happened? Is it possible they may have started growing again and have been a huge thorn in the side for the Israelites their entire life living in Canaan? Very possible. Caleb took care of the problem. And that goes, and it may not just be evolution or other things else, but that goes back to an idea is sometimes we're not confident enough to go into a situation because we don't know we don't have the knowledge. Do we study the enemy? I mean, that's why they sent spies into Canaan to start with, is they were trying to study the enemy. They were trying to figure out, okay, if we're going to go in here and overthrow these people, what are we up against? Do we understand the evil that we're facing in this world as Christians? Or do we just walk around in this almost like a haze, trying to ignore everything else going on around us? And we got to understand as Christians, we're in a war. I mean, there's a fight between good and evil going on. If we're not on God's side, whose side are we really on? And in order to be on God's side, do we have to be willing to step out and attack the evil that's in this world? Now, I'm not saying take up a sword and go kill somebody, but y'all know what I'm saying. In order for us to do that, we have to know our enemy. Do we understand? maybe the scientific side, if that's what we need to know. Do we understand the laws the way they're written? Well, and a lot of it, too, may just be the simple fact that we're not teaching our kids anything. We're just turning them over to somebody else to educate them. And I'm not saying don't send your kids to school. Yeah. But we have a responsibility for our children, our grandchildren, our families and stuff, to train them and to teach them how they take on this world, how they have the mindset that you're not somebody who's going to cower back from anything going on in this world and just assume Satan can have the world. I mean, what else are we here for as Christians? Exactly. Yep. You can't do it. Absolutely. And so we don't have the knowledge. We don't have the knowledge of the Bible. So if we want to sit down with somebody and have a Bible study, so many of us are so scared to do that. Well, why is it we're scared to do that? Because we're afraid they're going to ask us a question we don't know the answer to. Well, why don't we know the answer to the questions? Because we don't know the Bible ourselves. So, yep. There's a lot of things that if we can equip ourselves like Caleb did, there's a lot of big problems that we have the ability as Christians to tackle and to take on head on and to accomplish things for God that needs to be accomplished.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Thank you all for listening. I know some people got to go get kids and other stuff.